Ever get that feeling where there's just too much out there to know?
Uh-huh.
You wish you had a fast track to understanding the really important stuff, right? Mm. A way to, you know, cut through the noise and just get the insightful takeaways.
Definitely.
Well, that's precisely what we do here on the Deep Dive. We take the source material you've shared and extract the crucial insights, giving you that shortcut to being truly well-informed.
And this particular Deep Dive, we've crafted it with you, the learner, in mind. It looks at how we understand poverty in ways that go, well, way beyond just how much money someone has.
Exactly. You're someone who wants to grasp knowledge quickly but thoroughly, to connect the dots without getting bogged down.
So today we're diving deep into a paper called Deconstruction of the Alkire-Foster Poverty Model. And importantly, this isn't just a neutral explanation.
Right.
It's actually a critical look at a model. It's from the Carlos Medel Ramirez Institute at Universidad Veracruzana, written by Carlos Medel Ramirez just this past May.
And it really challenges a framework that's become, well, pretty influential in how poverty is understood around the globe.
Hugely influential, yeah.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack the core ideas of this Alkire-Foster model, but maybe even more importantly, to understand the serious questions and critiques raised in this paper.
We want you to see not just why it's popular, but also, you know, where it might fall short, the big debates around it.
Think of us as your guides through this sometimes complex but really important terrain.
And I'm here to offer some perspective on the intricacies of measuring these complex social and economic realities.
Okay, let's jump right in then. Because when we talk about poverty, for a long time, the main way we thought about it was, well, income.
Mm-hmm. That famous metric.
Yeah, you know, that famous metric of living on less than $1.90 a day. But as this paper points out, that single number really misses a huge part of what it means to be poor.
That's such a fundamental point. Our understanding has definitely evolved. We've moved from that narrow focus on income to recognizing that poverty is actually a tangled web of different kinds of deprivation.
Yeah, not just money.
Not just money, but also access to essential things like education, healthcare, decent housing.
Yeah.
Even the ability to participate fully in your community.
And this broader view really took hold thanks to the work of Amartya Sen, right? The paper mentions his capability approach. What's the sort of central idea there?
Well, what's fascinating here is Sen's core argument. Poverty isn't just about a lack of cash. It's about a lack of fundamental capabilities.
Capabilities.
Like abilities.
Kind of. They're the basic freedoms people need to live lives they have reason to value. So instead of just counting income, Sen urged us to think about what people can actually do and be.
Okay.
Like being healthy, being educated, being able to move around freely. Poverty, in this light, is the deprivation of these essential freedoms. He really pushed this idea back in the 1990s. Okay, so Sen gave us this really important way of thinking about poverty. And then Alkire and Foster came along. How did their model take these ideas and create a way to actually, you know, measure this multidimensional view?
Exactly. Alkire and Foster, who formalized their model around 2008, they took Sen's more philosophical concepts and developed a practical method. They created a framework to actually quantify multidimensional poverty.
Right, something usable.
Yeah, in a way that could be used for research and to inform policies.
Okay, so how does this Alkire-Foster framework actually work on the ground? Can you break down the key steps without getting too technical?
Sure. At its core, the AF model uses a few main ingredients. First, imagine a table that's your achievement matrix.
Okay, a table.
Down the side, you have a list of people, and across the top, you have different areas of well-being, like education, health, living standards,
right,
that sort of thing.
Right.
And you fill in the table with information about how each person is doing in each of these areas.
Got it. So it's like a snapshot showing everyone's situation across different dimensions of their life. What happens next?
Then you set deprivation cutoffs. For each of those areas, education, health, etc., you decide on a minimum level, a threshold.
A threshold, right.
If someone falls below that level, they're considered deprived in that area. So, for example, in education, maybe the cutoff is not having completed primary school.
So these cutoffs are like the red lines for what counts as being deprived in each aspect of well-being.
Precisely. Once you have these cutoffs, you count how many areas each person is deprived in.
Ah. Okay.
This gives you a deprivation score for every individual.
Okay, so each person gets a score based on how many things they're lacking. Now, how do we figure out who is actually considered multidimensionally poor?
This is where the poverty threshold, often called K, comes in.
Yeah.
K is the minimum number of deprivations someone must experience to be classified as multidimensionally poor. For example, you might say someone is poor if they're deprived in, say, at least 3 out of 10 dimensions.
Right, so K is another crucial threshold, the number of deprivations that pushes someone into the category of being poor.
Exactly.
And what kind of information does this model then give us? What are the key things it tells us?
Well, the model gives us several important pieces of information. First, there's the headcount ratio.
Headcount ratio.
Which is simply the percentage of people in the population who are identified as multidimensionally poor, the proportion of folks whose deprivation score meets or exceeds K.
That sounds pretty straightforward. Yeah. What else does it tell us?
Then there's the intensity measure.
Yeah.
This tells us, on average, what proportion of the possible deprivations the poor people are actually experiencing.
Okay.
So if K is 3 out of 10 dimensions and the average poor person is deprived in 5, the intensity would be 50%. It gives us a sense of how severely poor the poor are on average.
Okay. That gives us a sense of the depth of poverty. That makes sense.
Exactly. And finally, you have the adjusted headcount, often called the multidimensional poverty index or MPI.
The MPI.
Right. You get this by multiplying the headcount ratio by the intensity measure. It gives you a single number that reflects both how widespread poverty is and how deep it is.
So it's a combined measure of how many people are poor and how poor they are. Okay. Now, why has this Alkire-Foster model become so widely used? The paper mentions some of its appealing features.
Yeah, the paper highlights several key reasons for its popularity. It's seen as relatively simple and transparent. The steps involved are fairly easy to understand.
That helps.
It also has what's called axiomatic justification. Think of it as being built on a foundation of logical rules that should make it reliable.
Okay.
It's also decomposable, meaning you can break down poverty levels for different groups within a population. Plus, it can handle different types of data. Although we'll see why that's a point of debate later.
Okay. Bit of foreshadowing there.
Right. And it's flexible in terms of which dimensions you choose to include and how much importance or weight you give to each.
That flexibility does sound like a big advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been adopted by some major international organizations, right? Like the UN.
Absolutely. The UNDP uses the AF methodology in its Global Multidimensional Poverty Index, which gives it huge visibility and influence.
Wow.
And as the paper notes, OPHI mentions over 100 countries have used it for their own national poverty assessments.
Over 100 countries.
Yeah. This widespread adoption is partly because it aligns well with the Sustainable Development Goals, particularly SDG 1, ending poverty in all its forms.
So it's got this global stamp of approval. And the academic world has also generally been quite supportive, according to the paper.
Yes, generally. The academic research has often praised its theoretical soundness. Scholars have pointed out that it satisfies several desirable axioms.
Axioms, those logical rules again.
Exactly. Things like poverty focus, meaning it only looks at those identified as poor, decomposability, which we mentioned, and different forms of monotonicity, which basically means that if poverty gets worse, the index should reflect that. Alkire and Foster themselves wrote a lot about these foundations.
Okay, so at first glance, it seems like a really solid and useful tool. But the title of this paper, Deconstruction of the Alkire-Foster Poverty Model, suggests there's more to the story.
Definitely.
We're now moving into the critiques, the philosophical tensions. Where do the potential problems start to emerge? For you, the learner, trying to understand global poverty, what are the real-world dangers of relying too heavily on this model if these critiques hold up?
Right. This is where it gets really interesting. Despite its widespread use, the paper outlines some really significant cracks in this seemingly robust model. Cracks that can lead to surprising, even unfair outcomes in how we understand and address poverty.
Okay.
One of the first major points of contention is what's called the ordinal-cardinal misalignment.
Ordinal-cardinal misalignment. Okay, unpack that for us. What's the issue with ordinal and cardinal data in this context?
Essentially, the problem is this. The AF model often uses data that just tells you about order, whether someone is above or below a certain level, like having completed primary school, yes or no. This is ordinal data, rank order.
Yes, no, above, below, got it.
However, when the model combines these different deprivations to calculate the intensity of poverty and the overall MPI, it performs mathematical operations addition, multiplication that assume there are meaningful and equal distances between the values. That's cardinal logic, like counting things precisely.
So it's treating these yes or no deprivations as if they were precise measurements with equal steps between them, like inches on a ruler.
Precisely. The paper cites a critique by Revalian, who argues that this mixes fundamentally different kinds of information. It violates measurement theory, basically, and it can actually distort comparisons between different dimensions. Well, think about it. Is the distance between having completed primary school and having no schooling the same as the distance between having access to clean water and not having it?
Yeah.
The yes or no data doesn't tell you that, but the math treats them as comparable. The paper mentions measures like M1 and M2 as examples where these cardinal calculations are really used.
So it's like the data is speaking one language, you know, ranking, but the math is treating it like it's speaking another, like precise measurements.
Yeah.
And that creates a lot of confusion, or semantic noise, as the paper calls it.
Exactly. Semantic noise. That's a good term for it. But what's another key area of concern?
What's next?
Another really significant critique revolves around the arbitrary thresholds, particularly that poverty threshold K.
Ah, yes, K. The number of deprivations needed to be considered poor.
Yeah, it feels like choosing that K value could be quite a judgment call, right?
It does seem subjective.
Exactly. The paper highlights the argument that this subjective choice can dramatically influence who gets counted as poor and the overall poverty rate. Critics like Dodder and Klazin have pointed out that this can make it really difficult to compare poverty levels across different regions or time periods.
Why is that?
Well, imagine two countries with the exact same underlying levels of deprivation. If one country sets K at 3 deprivations and the other sets it at 4, they could report very different poverty rates.
Even though people's actual situations are identical.
Exactly. The paper calls this the cross-national comparability paradox, a prime example of a key insight here. It really undermines those global comparisons.
Wow.
And it also raises the concern that governments might even be tempted to, well, manipulate their reported poverty figures by strategically choosing a K that makes them look better.
So a government could potentially make it seem like poverty has gone down just by changing that K value, even if nothing has really improved for people on the ground. That seems problematic.
That's the worry, yes. The choice of K has a lot of power in shaping the results.
Okay, what about the actual severity of the deprivations themselves? Does the model take into account how serious a lack of something might be, or how different deprivations might make each other worse?
This is another really crucial area of critique. The model largely ignores the severity of individual deprivations and how they might interact.
How does that work?
In the initial step of identifying who is deprived, it's often just a binary yes or no. So lacking any access to clean drinking water counts the same as, say, not having access to a television in that initial count.
Wait, really? So a truly life-threatening deprivation gets the same weight as a much less critical one in the initial calculation?
In that initial count of how many deprivations someone has, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, measures like M1 and M2 do try to capture the extent of deprivation among those already identified as poor, looking at how far below the line they are. But the initial identification doesn't distinguish based on how severe a particular deprivation might be.
Okay, that distinction is important.
But there's more. The model doesn't really account for the fact that different deprivations can have synergistic effects. They can make each other worse.
Synergistic effect.
Yeah.
Like a domino effect.
Sort of. For example, a child who is malnourished is likely to learn much less effectively in school, right? Making both the health and education deprivations more severe together than they would be apart.
That makes sense.
The AF model doesn't automatically capture these interconnected impacts. It tends to treat each deprivation as kind of separate, even though in reality they often feed into each other and create a much more difficult situation overall.
It's like it's looking at a list of problems without seeing how those problems are connected and amplifying each other. That seems like a pretty significant oversight.
It can be, yeah.
The paper also talks about philosophical reductionism. What's the core idea behind that critique?
This critique, and it draws on thinkers like Nussbaum, argues that the AF model oversimplifies the complex and deeply personal nature of what it means to lack basic capabilities.
How does it oversimplify?
By boiling down these multifaceted human experiences into a simple yes or no in a matrix, and then using a universal way of adding them up, the model essentially erases the individual agency, the specific context, the element of choice, things that are so central to Sen's original capability approach.
So it reduces the richness of individual experiences and the reasons behind their deprivations into a set of checkboxes, losing the deeper story.
Exactly. It doesn't really consider why someone might lack a certain functioning. Was it due to a lack of opportunity? Was it a personal choice? Or was it the result of larger social injustices? The model tends to treat all absences as deprivations without that deeper understanding of the underlying causes.
And the last of these initial critiques mentioned is a lack of process sensitivity. What's the issue there?
This goes back to Sen's emphasis on the importance of how things happen, not just the final outcome. The AF model is largely focused on the outcome, whether someone is currently deprived or not.
A snapshot.
Exactly, a snapshot. It doesn't really look at the processes that led to those deprivations, the historical context, or the ongoing systems that might be keeping people in poverty. It's more static than dynamic.
So it tells us who is deprived at a particular moment, but not how they got there, or what's preventing them from escaping poverty. Okay, we've covered some fundamental concerns. Now, the paper digs deeper into formal logic inconsistencies. This sounds quite technical. What are the main logical problems the authors identify?
Right. It gets a bit more into the weeds here, but as we discussed with the ordinal cardinal issue, the AF model has those three basic logical steps. Identify achievements, convert to binary deprivations, aggregate.
Identify, convert, aggregate.
Okay. The paper argues there's a basic mismatch between the yes or no nature of the deprivation data, ordinal, and the way the model uses arithmetic operations to combine them in measures like M1, M2, and the broader MANA family, cardinal.
So it's not just a philosophical disagreement. There are actual logical problems with how the model uses the data.
That's the argument put forward here. The paper uses mathematical notation, things like yay, zj, c, k, m0, to really demonstrate why this mixing of ordinal and cardinal data is problematic. It essentially shows how it can lead to results that don't have a clear, unambiguous meaning.
Okay.
While certain transformations of the data monotonic ones don't affect the initial yes or no deprivation classification, they do create problems when you start doing arithmetic in the aggregation step. Because ordinal data doesn't have meaningful equal intervals between categories.
Right.
Treating it as if it does introduces what the paper, quoting Revalian again, calls semantic noise. The numbers might not really mean what we intuitively think they mean.
So it's like the data is giving us rankings, but the math is treating those rankings like precise measurements, and that creates potential confusion or misinterpretation in the results.
Precisely. Revalian's concern, highlighted here, is that doing this kind of mathematical manipulation on ordinal data can create misleading profiles of poverty, especially when comparing different people or groups.
And there's also a disconnect between the clear yes or no at the start and the more complex calculations later on, right?
All right.
The paper mentions discontinuity.
Yes, that's another key logical point. Once someone is identified as deprived or not, a binary outcome using that K threshold, the model then often works with what the paper calls censored data for aggregation.
Censored data.
Meaning if someone isn't poor, according to the K threshold, their deprivations might be set to zero in some calculations, like for M0. If they are poor, then their deprivation score is used. This creates a sharp break.
Eyes.
This creates a kind of logical asymmetry. A very small change in someone's situation right near the deprivation line or near the K threshold can cause a sudden jump or drop in the overall poverty measure or how their data contributes. It violates a sense of ethical continuity, the idea that our judgment shouldn't change drastically with tiny changes in circumstances.
It's like the model makes a sharp judgment at the beginning, identifying someone as poor or not poor, but then tries to use more detailed information later in a way that doesn't quite fit smoothly with that initial sharp judgment.
Exactly. And the paper also highlights the ongoing issue of trying to compare different dimensions of poverty. Even when we try to make them seem comparable, maybe using normalization or looking at percentage shortfalls,
yeah,
it doesn't necessarily mean those shortfalls are ethically equivalent. Is a 25% lack in education truly the same in terms of impact as a 25% lack in nutrition? The AF model doesn't give us a fundamental value metric to say they are. Or does using squared gaps, like in M2 or MA with A2, exaggerate the importance of, say, education shortfalls compared to health? We're still potentially comparing apples and oranges.
So even when we try to make the different dimensions look numerically comparable, they might not be comparable in terms of their real impact on people's lives. Mm-hmm. There's no underlying common unit of value.
Right. And what about this fallacy of dimensional equivalence the paper mentioned?
Yeah, what's it?
This refers back to the initial counting of deprivations, the psi score. The model usually treats all deprivations as equally important in that count. So being deprived in a relatively minor area counts the same towards reaching the K threshold as being deprived in a really critical area.
Even if you add weights later.
Well, you can assign different weights, WJ, to the dimensions when calculating the final MPI, which helps. But the initial count that determines if someone is pool based on K often remains unweighted or equally weighted.
Oh, okay.
This can lead to those paradoxical situations where someone with several less serious deprivations is counted as poor, while someone with a few very severe deprivations might not be, just because they don't cross the K threshold in enough dimensions.
So the number of check marks matters more than the severity of the check marks at that crucial identification stage.
Exactly. The paper stresses that just because you can count them equally doesn't mean they cause equal harm or represent equal levels of disadvantage.
That sounds like a really significant potential flaw. You could have someone facing really dire circumstances but not be counted as poor, while someone else with less severe issues is included in the count.
Precisely. The paper argues these logical and measurement issues undermine the model's claim to accurately reflect the complexities of poverty.
Okay. Moving on, the paper then examines axiomatic weaknesses. We touched on the idea that the AF model claims to meet certain logical rules or axioms. What does the paper find when it looks at these claims more closely?
Right. Axioms, in this context, are like fundamental ethical and logical filters, tests that a good way of measuring poverty should pass.
Like quality control checks.
Kind of, yeah. The AF model claims to satisfy several key ones. Anonymity symmetry, it doesn't matter who is poor. Monotonicity, if poverty worsens, the measure should go up. Dimensional monotomicity, if someone becomes deprived in another area, poverty should go up. Decomposability, you can break down poverty for different groups. Poverty focus, it only looks at the poor. Normalization and transfer sensitivity. Transferring resources from poorer to less poor should ideally increase measured poverty.
That sounds like a good list, but...
But the paper's detailed analysis reveals several areas where the model, particularly the commonly used versions like M0, falls short or has nuances.
Okay. For example, how does it hold up with monotonicity, the idea that if a poor person becomes more deprived, the overall poverty level should increase?
Well, the paper argues that for the simplest version of the AF measure, M0, which combines headcount and intensity, monotonicity actually fails in a specific way.
How so?
Because the initial step is just a yes or no for being deprived in each dimension, and M0 relies on this. If someone who is already below the cutoff in a certain area becomes even more deprived in that same area, say, their income drops further below the poverty line, or they get even less schooling, M0 won't show any change as long as they remain below that cutoff in that dimension.
So the intensity part of M0 doesn't capture worsening within a dimension?
Not if the person is already identified as deprived in that dimension. The change is censored by that initial binary identification. It doesn't capture the increasing depth of their deprivation within that category for the M0 calculation.
So someone's situation could get much worse in a specific area they're already deprived in, but the basic M0 poverty measure wouldn't even register that change. That seems counterintuitive.
It does. What about dimensional monotonicity? The idea that if a poor person becomes deprived in another area, the poverty level should go up.
Does that hold?
Generally, yes, but the paper points out it might not hold if the added dimension is very low weighted, or again, if the person's overall deprivation count is already well above the K threshold. Adding one more minor deprivation might not be enough to significantly shift the overall M0 index.
Okay, so there are edge cases. And what about decomposability? The ability to break down the overall poverty level into contributions from different groups in society.
The AF model is arithmetically decomposable. You can calculate overall poverty as a weighted average of poverty in different subgroups, like urban versus rural. That works mathematically. But the paper raises concerns about whether it's semantically decomposable, meaning does the index actually mean the same thing in these different contexts? The relative importance of dimensions, the nature of deprivations, might differ so much that simply comparing the numerical MPI values across groups could be misleading, even if the math adds up.
So the numbers might add up correctly, but the underlying reality they represent could be quite different for different groups. How does the model fare with transfer sensitivity? That sounds important. The idea that taking from the poorest to give to the less poor is bad.
This is highlighted as a significant weakness for the most common AF measures. Transfer sensitivity in its standard form is only satisfied by M2.
Only M2, not M0 or M1.
Correct. M2 is the version that specifically penalizes inequality among the poor by squaring the deprivation gaps. M0 and M1, which are used much more often in policy analysis and global reports, don't necessarily satisfy this. They are largely blind to inequality among the poor.
What does that mean, practically?
It means that even if you redistribute deprivations in a way that makes the poorest people worse off and the slightly less poor better off, but still poor, the M0 or M1 measures might not increase. They might even decrease in some scenarios, depending on how intensity changes. They don't reliably capture changes in the distribution of deprivation among the poor.
So unless you're using this more complex M2 measure, the model might not capture worsening inequality among those who are already poor. That seems like a major limitation for policy.
It is considered a limitation, yes. The paper concludes this section by emphasizing that while the AF model might formally meet many of these logical tests on paper, a closer look reveals these underlying inconsistencies, sensitivities, and weaknesses, especially with the more commonly used versions, M0, M1. This raises questions about its overall reliability as a guide.
Okay, so the logical and foundational aspects have some serious cracks, according to this analysis. Now, the paper moves on to what it calls consequential absurdities. This sounds like we're getting into the real-world problems that can arise from using this model. What are some of these problematic outcomes?
Right. This section really highlights how certain built-in features of the AF model can lead to unintended and sometimes quite problematic results when applied in the real world.
Such as?
Well, one major issue we already touched on is the arbitrary power of K, that poverty cutoff threshold.
No, the number of deprivations.
As you increase K, meaning someone has to be deprived in more and more areas to be considered poor, the number of people counted as poor automatically goes down. Mathematically, AJIC is negative.
That seems almost too obvious, but what's the absurdity in that?
The absurdity lies in the implication. You can have two countries, or the same country over time, with exactly the same underlying levels of hardship and deprivation among their people.
Okay.
But if they simply choose different K values, they will report drastically different poverty rates, headcount H and often M0. The paper calls this the cross-national comparability paradox again.
Right.
It fundamentally undermines our ability to meaningfully compare poverty levels across different places or track progress reliably because the results are so dependent on this somewhat arbitrary choice of K. As Dotter and Klaisen pointed out, it makes cross-country comparisons very fragile.
So differences in reported poverty might just reflect different choices about this K value rather than actual differences in people's lives. That really undermines the value of those international comparisons, doesn't it?
It certainly raises questions. What other problematic outcomes does the paper discuss?
What else?
Another really concerning outcome is that the model can actually create an incentive to underreport poverty.
Oh.
Because simply raising the K value mechanically makes the poverty rate H and the adjusted headcount M0 go down, governments might be tempted to strategically choose higher K values to make it look like they are making progress in reducing poverty, even if the underlying deprivations haven't actually changed much.
So the model itself could unintentionally encourage governments to manipulate the numbers to look better, rather than focusing on actual improvements. That's a pretty serious potential flaw.
It's a concern raised in the paper, yes. Then there's also what the paper calls the identification paradox.
Identification paradox.
This refers back to those situations where someone who is deprived in a few really critical, severe areas might not be counted as poor because they don't meet the K threshold.
Right.
They only have two deprivations, but K3. While someone else who is deprived in several less severe, maybe more trivial areas is counted as poor because they happen across that K threshold number.
Because of the equal counting in that.
Well, it's exactly because of the dimensional equivalence in the initial count and the sharp logic of the K threshold.
It's like the example we talked about earlier, someone lacking basic survival necessities might be overlooked, while someone with less critical issues ends up being counted as poor. That seems fundamentally unfair.
It highlights a potential misidentification problem, absolutely. Yeah. The paper also discusses threshold sensitivity and policy volatility.
Volatility.
Yeah. Because someone's poverty status, poor or not poor, depends entirely on whether they cross that K threshold, even small changes in people's lives right near that boundary, or small changes in the data collected can lead to sudden and artificial jumps or drops in the reported poverty rates. This can also cause instability in who is eligible for social programs that might be targeted based on this measure. It makes planning difficult and could undermine public trust if eligibility seems to flicker on and off without large changes in circumstances.
So minor changes near the line can create big, potentially disruptive shifts in who is considered poor and who gets assistance. That sounds chaotic.
It can be. And this can also lead to a misallocation of resources in social spending.
How so?
because the model might miss those with fewer but more severe deprivations if they fall below K, aid might inadvertently be directed towards those with more numerous but less critical needs who do cross K. This leads to what economists call welfare leakage aid, going to those who need it less, and exclusion errors, missing those who need it most.
That's a really worrying practical implication for effective policy. What else contributes to these problematic outcomes?
Well, the paper reminds us again of the problem of ignoring how different deprivations can interact and make each other worse, those synergies.
Right, the malnutrition and education example.
Exactly. Because the model largely treats deprivations independently, it doesn't inherently capture these synergistic effects. Malnutrition makes it harder to learn, lack of sanitation increases health risks, etc. This compounding harm isn't typically factored in, potentially flattening the poverty profile and underestimating the true depth of disadvantage for those facing multiple interacting problems. The paper even suggests a simple formula, mis-synergy, as a way this could be considered.
It's like, it's not seeing the full weight of the burden when multiple problems hit at once. What about how the model deals with time and how long someone has been in poverty? Does that cause absurdities?
Yes, the AF model's focus on a single point in time, its atemporal nature, leads to another set of problematic outcomes. It essentially treats someone experiencing a brief, transient period of hardship the same as someone trapped in chronic, long-term poverty.
No difference.
Not in the standard MPI calculation. It doesn't consider the duration, depth over time, or trajectory of deprivation. These are really important aspects for understanding poverty's impact and designing interventions, but the snapshot approach misses them.
So someone who just temporarily falls below a threshold might be counted the same as someone who's been living in deep poverty for years. That lack of a time dimension seems like a major weakness in practice.
It is. And relatedly, the paper points out that the model fails to capture what's called relational poverty.
Relational poverty.
Things like social exclusion, lack of political voice, power asymmetries, discrimination based on gender, ethnicity, etc. The AF model focuses on individual achievements, or lack thereof, and largely ignores the broader social context, let's call it C, that shakes people's opportunities and constraints.
How does that play out?
Someone facing significant discrimination might have similar individual achievements, maybe same education level as someone in a more privileged group, but their real capabilities, their actual freedoms and opportunities could be vastly different. The model wouldn't necessarily reflect that systemic disadvantage.
So it misses the impact of social inequalities and systemic barriers that are often core drivers of poverty. And finally, the paper touches on the danger of public misinterpretation and using the index for the wrong purposes. Index. Instrumentalization.
Yes, exactly. Because the AF model produces a seemingly simple and clear number, the MPI, there's a risk that policymakers, the media, and the public might not fully understand its underlying complexities, assumptions, and limitations.
They just see the numbers.
Right. And this apparent simplicity can also make it vulnerable to being used for political gain, where the focus becomes manipulating the index to show progress, maybe by changing K or focusing on easily moved dimensions, rather than genuinely tackling the deep structural root causes of poverty.
It becomes more about the headline number than about the complex reality of people's lives. It sounds like these consequential absurdities highlight some really serious practical limitations and potential dangers of relying too heavily on the AF model.
They certainly do. The paper argues strongly that a good way of measuring poverty shouldn't create these kinds of perverse incentives or systematically misguide policy. Without addressing these issues, the AF model risks leading to unfair or ineffective approaches to poverty reduction.
Okay, we've looked at the logical problems, the weaknesses in its axiomatic foundations, and these quite startling real-world consequences. Now we come to the final area of critique outlined in the paper, philosophical incoherence. Given that the AF model is supposed to be based on Amartya Sen's capability approach, how does the paper argue that it actually falls short philosophically?
Right. This is perhaps the most fundamental level of critique discussed. While the AF model explicitly aims to operationalize Sen's capability approach, to put it into practice, the paper argues that the way it actually works ends up deviating from or even contradicting some of the core philosophical principles of that very approach. Sen himself, you know, warned us not to just automatically assume someone lacks freedom simply because they aren't achieving a particular outcome or functioning.
So the model might be measuring the lack of certain things in people's lives, like education or health, but not necessarily the lack of freedom or capability to have those things. Is that the idea?
Exactly. That's a central point. there's a confusion between functioning failure and capability deprivation. Sun made a crucial distinction between what people actually do or are, their functionings, and their real opportunities and freedoms to achieve those things, their capabilities.
Okay.
The AF model largely looks at observed functionings, whether someone is educated, is healthy, etc., but it doesn't adequately consider whether they had the genuine freedom and opportunity to achieve those states. Was the lack of education due to no schools being available or prohibitive costs, or was it a choice?
Right.
It also doesn't really account for individual agency and voluntariness. Someone might choose not to pursue a particular functioning for their own valid reasons, cultural, religious, personal, but the model would typically still count that absence as a deprivation.
Like the example the paper gives of a fasting monk, they are choosing to go without adequate nutrition for a period, but the standard model would just see a nutritional deprivation score.
Precisely. The model struggles to differentiate between a lack that's due to constrained opportunity sets and one that reflects a deliberate, valued choice. It risks imposing a uniform view of desirable functionings.
What about adaptive preferences? How does that fit in philosophically?
That's another key philosophical tension. Adaptive preferences refer to the idea that people who have been deprived for a long time, living in oppressive conditions, might lower their expectations and desires. They might genuinely say they are satisfied with less, even if they are objectively lacking basic capabilities by external standards.
So they've adapted to their constraints.
Yes. The AF model, with its objective, often externally defined thresholds and dimensions, doesn't really investigate or capture these internalized limitations or potentially concealed unmet needs. It might take stated satisfaction or observe functioning at face value, missing deeper capability failures masked by adaptation.
So it might miss situations where people have been forced to accept less or don't even aspire to more, and therefore don't appear deprived according to the model's fixed criteria.
That's the concern raised, yes. Another core idea in the capability approach is value pluralism.
Value pluralism.
The recognition that there isn't just one single way for people to live good, flourishing lives. There are many different, potentially conflicting values and priorities people might have.
Okay.
The AF model, by reducing this complex reality to a binary vector, a set of yes or no deprivations, and then aggregating them, often treating all dimensions as equally substitutable in the initial count, arguably squashes this rich diversity. It risks turning the pursuit of freedom into a simplistic checklist. Sand himself cautioned against that.
It loses the nuance of different values and the potential incommensurability of different kinds of freedoms. What about the role of the social context, which we touched on earlier in the practical issues? How is that a philosophical problem?
Philosophically, the capability approach emphasizes that people's ability to convert resources, like income or assets, into actual valuable functionings is heavily influenced by their social environment. Things like social norms, discrimination, political climate, access to public services, community networks. These are sometimes called social conversion factors.
Right, the context die.
The AF model, with its primary focus on individual or household achievements, largely ignores how this social context systematically advantages some and disadvantages others. Two people with the same individual attributes might have vastly different real freedoms depending on their gender, ethnicity, location, etc., but the model wouldn't necessarily show that difference adequately. Nussbaum, for instance, argued strongly that capabilities are fundamentally political entitlements that depend on these enabling social and institutional factors.
So the model doesn't really account philosophically for the systemic barriers and structural injustices that are often the root cause of capability deprivation. Mm-hmm. What about the lack of a time dimension? How does that relate to the philosophical issues?
The model's focus on a single point in time, its temporal blindness, also clashes with the philosophical emphasis on human lives unfolding over time and the importance of process. Sen argued that justice isn't just about the end state or outcome, but also about the fairness of the processes that lead there.
Right.
By focusing on a static snapshot, the AF model misses the dynamics of chronic versus transient poverty, vulnerability, resilience, life trajectories, all of which are crucial for a deeper, philosophically richer understanding of well-being and deprivation over a lifetime.
It's a static picture that doesn't capture the flow and history of people's experiences with poverty, which seems philosophically inadequate. And finally, the paper discusses how the AF model kind of replaces ethical deliberation with a technical aggregation procedure. What's the philosophical problem with that?
Well, the capability approach, as originally conceived by Sen, is deeply connected to public reasoning, democratic deliberation, and social choice. deciding which capabilities matter most, where to set thresholds, how to value different dimensions. These are fundamentally ethical and political questions that should ideally involve public discussion and include the voices of those affected.
Makes sense.
The AF model, however, often relies on experts or policymakers to pre-select the dimensions, set the deprivation cutoffs, and determine the weights, sometimes based on statistical properties or existing data, rather than deep ethical reflection or participation. The paper argues that this technocratic approach can supplant or marginalize crucial public debate. It risks depoliticizing poverty, turning it into a technical problem to be managed rather than a matter of social justice to be debated and addressed collectively.
So the very process of defining and measuring poverty gets taken out of the hands of the public and becomes an expert-driven exercise, potentially losing ethical legitimacy and responsiveness along the way. It sounds like the paper makes a really strong case that while the AF model was inspired by the capability approach, it ends up falling short in some really significant philosophical ways.
It does present a strong critique on those grounds, yes. The paper concludes this section by arguing that by translating a rich philosophical and political concept into a seemingly neutral technical tool for counting, the AF model risks obscuring crucial aspects of freedom and justice, potentially even becoming a way to manage or contain poverty rather than fundamentally challenging the structures that create it. It loses sight of the very capabilities and freedoms it originally aimed to champion.
Wow. Well, this has been an incredibly insightful and quite critical deep dive into the deconstruction of the Alkire-Foster model based on this paper. Just to quickly summarize the key critiques we've walked through, it highlighted logical inconsistencies, particularly that ordinal-cardinal mismatch.
Right. Using the wrong math for the type of data.
Functional contradictions in simply counting deprivations equally at first.
Yeah.
Weaknesses in its underlying logical rules or axioms, like monotonicity and transfer sensitivity.
Especially for the common M0 and M1 measures.
Then those really problematic real-world consequences, the absurdities like the potential for manipulation, the paradoxes in comparison and identification.
And ignoring synergies and time.
And finally, these fundamental ways in which it arguably doesn't align with the philosophical ideas of the capability approach that inspired it. Issues around agency, context, and deliberation.
Exactly. And understanding these different layers of critique is so important, I think, for anyone who cares about social issues, policy development, you name it.
Absolutely.
It really shows that even seemingly objective ways of measuring complex things like poverty are built on certain assumptions, value judgments, and they have real limitations we need to be aware of.
So for you, the learner listening to this, we really encourage you to think critically about how poverty is measured wherever you encounter it, and what the implications of those measurement choices might be.
Definitely. And you might find it valuable to explore the original paper further, if you're interested, particularly the section where it suggests potential alternative approaches or reforms.
Right. What sort of things does it mention?
Well, it briefly touches on ideas like developing methods that are more sensitive to individual agency and context, maybe mapping relational capabilities, incorporating temporal metrics that look at poverty over time, and crucially, using more participatory methods that involve communities in defining and measuring poverty themselves.
So moving beyond the purely technical fit.
Yeah, towards measures that are maybe more grounded in lived experience and democratic values.
Okay. This whole discussion really raises a fundamental, maybe provocative question for us to consider as we wrap up. If the very tools we use to understand and measure something as profound as poverty have these kinds of potential flaws, logical, practical, philosophical, what does that really say about our ability to truly grasp its complexities and develop truly effective, just solutions?
That's a really powerful thought to end on. If the map is flawed, how well can we navigate the territory?
Exactly. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
It's been a very thought-provoking discussion. Thank you.